Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the Kalamcast podcast. My guest for this episode is a social media influencer known as the Hijabi Nurse. As well as being an influencer, she is a qualified paramedic and a nurse. Here is my interview with her, which I recorded much earlier. I apologize for loss of audio in the first part of the interview. As you will hopefully see, however, it doesn't really take away anything from the amazing insights our sister has with regards to her profession. So without any further ado, here's the recording.
They would whisper this to me, you know, like women that are not wearing hijabs or like men or whatever. And when I say women not wearing hijab, I do not believe that if you don't wear hijab, that means you're not a good Muslim. That's not what I believe. But I'm just saying that I'm, you know, proudly repping Islam and proudly repping the deen. And I have people stopping me to tell me like, wow, you know, like you're doing something that I don't have the confidence to do. And that made me feel like, that made me feel proud of myself, obviously, but it made me feel like, why? It made me question it. It worried me, honestly, like about like the status of our ummah. Like we should have confidence. Like, you know, like there's nothing wrong with us. We're such amazing people. Why are we not confident to represent who we actually are? So slowly, you know, the idea would cook inside me, and the desire to want to change it would just get stronger and stronger every single time someone approached me to tell me how proud they were of me. I felt like, why are you proud of me? I'm not doing anything special. Why are you proud? So then I realized that, well, they're proud because apparently I have guts to step out this way in America. And I felt like that needed to change. I felt like it shouldn't be something that requires guts. You know what I'm saying? So I felt like, wow, like, you know, I don't want to be one in a million when it comes to something like this. I want every Muslim or every minority to feel like there's zero wrong with being who you are, and you should be proud of it and you should rep it. And if it's what, you know, lines up well with you, you know, to go to work with your hijab on, or to, you know, dress however you want to dress because of your religion, because of your beliefs, then do it. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't stop you. That's another thing. People always like come up to me and they're like, you know, how did you get this far with a hijab? I'm like, what? what are you saying? Like, has there been people along the way who have been Islamophobic towards me? Yes, of course. Have I lost opportunities, quote unquote opportunities, because people didn't like the fact that I was wearing a hijab? Of course. But you gotta believe deep down inside that Allah is the best of planners, and something that you in your head feel is an opportunity gets shut down because you're trying to live your life the way Allah wants you to live it, then guess what? It wasn't the best opportunity for you anyway. So you just keep doing what you're doing, do the right thing. More opportunities will come your way. Like, that's pretty much, you know, the whole A through Z of how the idea started and why I'm still doing it, why I never gave up on it. It's been like probably 4 to 5 years of it now.
What I basically understand from you and from listening to past audio presentations from yourself is that you're pretty much an extrovert. Is it safe to say that?
Yeah, I actually, I did the Myers-Briggs personality test for the first time when I was, I think, 18 or 19, and I got ENFP. The E stands for extrovert, and I do it just for fun, like, every year, just to see if it changed, and it hasn't. I'm still very well an ENFP.
Now, do you think that everyone could do what it is that you're actually doing with your platform?
Yes, I do, because here's the thing. If someone is, let's say, I'll tell you this. So the way that I am on the internet is the way that I am in real life. There's no difference. And I think that's the extrovert in me, is that like, even if I'm standing in front of a crowd of hundreds of people, which I have done before, I can still speak my mind the same exact way. People don't faze me. People don't make me nervous. People don't like it. It's the opposite, actually. When I'm around people, like, my energy just goes up and I'm like, you know, like, and I think that's the extrovert in me. But if I was an introvert, then I could still make a huge impact online and then maybe, you know, have a little bit more of a rough time for like actual like face-to-face events because I'm introverted, you know, if I was introverted. But online, man, oh my gosh, it's just you and your camera. You're all alone. Like it's, you know what I'm saying? Like the internet, oh, it's such a crazy place. It's such a crazy world, you know? And if you actually have good things to put out online, then oh my God, like you're wasting energy by not doing that. So the internet, basically the way I view it is people that, let's say like 50 years ago, you know, like they couldn't get their voice across, they can now. And that's a good thing and a bad thing, because 50 years ago there were like weirdos that would like just stay in the corner of their house and be weird in the corner of their house. But now these people have, you know, Instagram accounts and they have like Snapchats, and now they're being weird for the whole world to see. And weird could be whatever you want it to be. And then also 50 years ago there were people that had amazing messages, but they could only spread their message to their family, their friends, their neighbors. It couldn't really spread far. So if you have a good message and you're not putting it out there because, you know, you're saying that you're shy, or you're saying you're introverted, or you're doubting yourself, you don't think it's going to make an impact, you're doing yourself a huge disservice. Like the world needs to hear positive people so much more.
It's interesting to me that you describe personal qualities such as extroversion as being something weird. So I think that's quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, no, that's not what I meant. I didn't mean that being an extrovert was being weird. I meant that, for example, I don't know if you like scroll through like these apps that are trending, like for example, TikTok, you know, like there's a lot of weird people on TikTok.
Right.
But what I'm trying to say is that like back then, like 50 years ago, well, not just that, like let's say someone like sets fire to, I don't know, like something retarded, like they're doing something stupid. Well, 50 years ago they would do it like either just alone or for a crowd of five. Now people are doing these stupid things for a crowd of millions in public. Because of the internet, you know. And and they could be extroverted, introverted, that's not the case. The whole point of it was that like people, you know, now have a voice to reach millions, whether they're reaching millions in a retarded way or they're reaching millions in a very like positive, uplifting, motivating way.
Are you a TikTok person, by the way?
No, I tried. I actually tried, and maybe one day like I'll get the hang of it. But for some reason, I don't know how to use the thing. Like I don't know how to do it.
From what I understand, it's mostly a platform for teenagers.
It is mostly a platform for teenagers, but you know what? It's a huge problem, I find, when you give teenagers, you know, a platform where they can reach millions. Because when you're a teenager, your brain hasn't fully developed. First of all, you think you're invincible when you're a teenager. You think you can pull anything off and it's not going to hurt you. You're emotionally not developed. And your hormones are all over the place when you're a teenager. You go on TikTok and these little kids, they're like 13, 14, 15, they're, oh my God, it's a mess. It's honestly a mess. Like, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, you need to go and see it for yourself. It's messy in there when you look at what the teenagers are doing. So I think that if, like, us adults, I'm 25, so, like, my youngest sibling is 13. And sometimes she says stuff that I'm like, what did you just say? Like, and it makes, not in a bad way, but I just don't know what she's saying. I literally don't know what she's saying. And it reminds me of like those movies I used to watch when like the dad or the mom would say something and the kids would be like, oh my God, like you're not cool. You know what I mean? Like it makes me feel like I'm old because these kids are just developing these new trends so rapidly. And it makes such a disconnection between us and them, even though we're only like 10 years apart. So I think if people our age who are actually like level-headed can find a way to, you know, to talk to these kids without looking uncool, I think, oh my God, I think they really need that, because I'm telling you, it is a huge mess in that little TikTok world.
I think that's a good point, actually. And just sort of reminds me of another point that was made in a previous episode. I'm not sure if you've heard the episode that Brother Almir did on, you know, that Netflix series Messiah.
No, okay. I haven't heard it.
So basically there's this one scene in that series where this actor portraying Jesus, he's being taken pictures of through someone else's Instagram, a young girl, basically. You know, he recognizes that this young girl is watching him and, you know, taking pictures of him. And the context sort of allows you to think that maybe he's going to get angry at her. But the reality is he takes a look at the Instagram and he informs her, you should choose this picture is the best. And through that, it sort of allows for this friendship to occur between, you know, this character of Jesus within the series and this teenage girl. And basically the takeaway from that is that some of these young people, their entire world is just Instagram and so forth, this and that. And by him opening up to her in this way, he's you know, allowing himself to connect with her. So I imagine it's something very similar. If someone wants to really connect with some of the youth, maybe this is the way, right?
Oh yeah, listen, so I'll tell you this. My whole life I went to a private Muslim school except kindergarten and second grade, and then grade 10, 11, 12 I was homeschooled. My siblings now also have been in an Islamic school pretty much also their whole life, and they're still in it now. Back then, and still until now, but now it's worse because of the advancements in technology, the biggest problem is that adults will try so hard to stop kids from doing what they're doing. Like, for example, they'll stop kids. They'll be like, you're not allowed to use TikTok. You're not allowed to use Instagram. You're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to do that. But all that does is it teaches kids to have two personalities. It teaches them to have one personality for the adults and then another personality for the rest of the world. And that's so bad. It teaches them to lie. It teaches them to hide things. You know, I told you not to use TikTok. Why are you still on it? And then they'll lie. I'm like, no, I'm not. I don't have an account. I don't. Look, dude, look at my phone. It's not in there. And it's because they just deleted it. Why? Because they can re-download it in like 5 seconds. I think that the biggest problem right now with adults is that they do it with a good heart. They do it because they're scared for these kids, but it's wrong. What they need to do is they need to get with the program, and they need to realize that these things are unfortunately unavoidable. So the best thing you can do for the youth is simply to teach them how to use these things responsibly and how to use them smartly. Like, I have, like I said, a 13-year-old sister. I have a 15-year-old brother, 17-year-old sister, and a 21-year-old brother. With the younger ones, the 13 and the 15, I can't stop them from using TikTok. My mom, who is turning 50 this year, mashallah, she's so harsh on them. She wants them, like, delete TikTok. You're not allowed to use it. Me, because I'm 25, I know that that doesn't work. That does not work. Mm. So I bring my brother and my sister to my room and I'm like, guys, listen, I know mama wants you guys to delete TikTok, but listen, let's get real. You and I both know you're only going to delete it when she's around and you're going to download it again and use it when she's not around. Yes or no? And they start laughing. They're like, how did you know? I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. And they're laughing. And I'm like, yeah, I know. And you know, I know. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to teach you guys and remind you guys of how to ethically use TikTok, how to Islamically use it. And basically, Islam is so simple. If you're, you know, whether you're a guy or a girl, you need to lower your gaze when you see something inappropriate. So that means, do you need to delete all of TikTok? No. But if you come across something that you know that for you to watch that you need to be alone hiding under your blanket, then guess what? It means you need to scroll past it really quickly. And what that does to the youth is it instills in them moral values. It instills in them ethics, and it gives them a route to take. Because if all you tell them is don't use this, then what's going to happen when they use it or when they see something inappropriate in real life? They're not going to have that voice in their head, or they're not going to have that moral compass to be like, oh, this is when I need to lower my gaze. This is when I need to turn my cheek. This is when I need to, you know, like scroll down like this. You know what I'm saying? If you just tell them, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, then what are they supposed to do when they're in that situation? Now they're lost. Now they're just going to succumb to their own emotions. You know what I'm saying? Like, it doesn't work like that. So with the youth, in a nutshell, adults need to go with the flow, go with the trends, and give their kids the tools that they need to ethically and morally use these trends.
It's an interesting way of looking at things. It sort of reminds me of the practice of a friend. A friend of mine actually takes his children to the, you know, cinema to watch actual movies, cartoons, and things like that. And some people within his community ask why. And he basically says, you know, he wants to show them that this is nothing. This is not something to pursue or something to do secretly. So he takes them and actually does it himself. So it's a very, I guess, interesting approach to apps such as this. I suppose the other thing I'm very curious about is, how does your work online lean into your actual job?
So basically, every single time I show up online, my goal is to give the people that are watching me or reading what I'm writing or whatever, give them value in any way, shape, or form. So whether that is, you know, by the end of this post, I want them to feel inspired. By the end of this post, I want them to learn something new. By the end of this post, I want them to have the guts to go out and be themselves and whatever the case may be. So that's always my goal online. I don't just show up online just to show up. It's always with a goal, and that is always what the goal is. So in real life, the work that I do is, right now I'm a paramedic, and alhamdulillah, I just got hired as a nurse in a trauma emergency room. So alhamdulillah, that's the work that I do in real life. Maybe I'm not really understanding exactly what your question is targeting, but it's always the same thing that I'm representing, whether online or in real life, because In both cases, I'm repping my deen. In both cases, I'm representing Islam, and I'm proudly wearing my hijab. And in real life, people see me, like, for example, sometimes my patients are Muslim, and they're like, whoa, like, you work in the emergency room, like, you work in America, and you're wearing this hijab, like, what? I'm like, yeah, like, there's zero wrong with that. Like, don't let that stop you. You know what I'm saying? So it's like I said, even before, like, the way I am online is the same exact way that I am in real life. So I'm not sure if that answered your question, or if I really understood what your question was, but
that's okay. We can unpack it further as we go. I guess what I was sort of targeting was, how well do your colleagues actually know that you'd perform this kind of work outside of actual physical work?
So actually, recently, someone that I work with found me on Instagram. I'm not really sure how, and then added me, and then was so, like, I don't know, either inspired or surprised at what I was doing, they started sharing my account. So now pretty much my entire department has me on Instagram. So they're very, very, very well aware of what I do online, and they're so supportive of it. Like, they're, every time they see me, you know, they're like, yo, it's the hijabi nurse. Like, they're supportive of it, and they're not even Muslim. There's only one other Muslim in my department. And the rest of them are not. And they're just so supportive of it and so loving of the concept.
So do you even tell your patients, hey, by the way, I'm on Instagram. Do you do any of that?
The reason I don't do that is because I don't really know, you know, what my patients' like actual lives are about. I've probably told a patient about my Instagram probably like 3 patients in this entire time frame. And it's only because, like, they were, you know, students within the medical field, and they were like feeling down and stuff. And I was like, hey, you know, I understand. And I'm always posting like positive stuff. I feel like it could help you. And, you know, I would mention it like that. But like, other than that, like, nah, not really. Cause it's also like a safety thing, you know, like you don't know what your patients do when they go home. Like, what if there's some like creep, like living, like, this is America at the end of the day, you know what I mean? Like, people are on both sides of the spectrum. You got like people that are totally normal and they're living great lives, and you got people that are nuts, like insane. You know, and in the medical field, especially emergency, you see them all. And yeah, it's just not a good idea.
Well, I suppose that brings me to another interesting question. And that is, I mean, have any interactions gone sour whilst you're doing this kind of work online?
Obviously, occasionally, there will be like, you know, like a hater or like someone that has an issue with what I'm doing. Like, I don't do it too much now because I'm so busy. But before, I used to like every single Friday come online and go live on Instagram and recite Surah Al-Kahf just to like, you know, motivate people to do the same with me, or just like, you know what I mean? Just like for all good purposes. And then obviously, you know, I had those few people that are like, hey sister, you know, the voice of them, of the women is Auda. Like, calm down. Like, I'm reciting Quran, and I'm like, you know what I mean, like, I'm doing it for a good, you know, goal, like a good intention, like, calm down. So there's that, for example. Rarely are the comments ever terrible. One time this guy commented something related to like me hiding like bombs on my ambulance, you know what I mean? Oh, but wow. Like, yeah, but like, whatever, who cares? Listen, people need to not give the negativity of a bigger voice than it has, because people are gonna say hateful things, people are gonna be trolls. It's the internet. Some people, it's literally their hobby. That like they're like posting these comments, and then if only like you saw them like as they're posting it in real life, like, you're just gonna see like some, you know, kid laughing as he's posting a hateful comment. Like, what are you gonna do, cry on the other end of your phone? Like, that just doesn't make any sense. So yeah, that's pretty much the answer to that one.
Okay, that's interesting to know. How often do you post?
These days, again, because I'm like so busy, unfortunately the posts come in waves. So, but because every single time I post, I'm like always trying to like be like make it be a meaningful post, they're rare, they're not really that as often as they should be. Actually, I'll tell you right now, my last post was January 22nd. You see, like, I'm so bad at this stuff. And the one before it was January 19, and the one before it was January 17. Like, I'm not that good at keeping up online, because in real life, my life is so busy in real life. But it is one of my goals to, like, you know, be more active on it. But I don't know when I'll be able to make that happen.
So how did this come about to begin with? You know, how did you get interested in this field of paramedicine?
So it actually started from a very, very, very young age. So by ethnicity, I'm a Palestinian. I was born in New York, and I've never seen Palestine, unfortunately. But growing up, I would always see videos of things that are happening in Palestine. And the videos would just break my heart, you know, because you would just see kids, parents, grandparents, literally anybody and everybody. There was no mercy at all. Just literally getting shot left and right, just getting shot down left and right, shot in the limbs, in the head, in the torso, like wherever, you know, or just getting tortured, getting beaten up, you know, by men fully armed. You know what I'm saying? Like, it broke my heart. And I grew up watching that, like, on the news. So when I was younger, I would ask, like, what's going on? Like, well, how come no one's helping them? Like, how come they're just like suffering? And the answer would always be, there's just not enough people there to help. There's not enough doctors. There's not enough paramedics. There's not enough nurses to help. And then, you know, I heard about that time where I forget which country sent medical aid. They sent doctors and nurses and paramedics and medical equipment, life-saving equipment, by boat and the whole boat got shot down and everybody on it died before it even reached Palestine. You know what I'm saying? Like, just it made me feel like, oh my God, like these people really, really, really need medical help. And I put it in my mind from a young age that, well, if there's not enough, you know, medical providers to go there and help, then I'm going to become a medical provider and I'm going to go there and help. And literally, you can ask like anyone that's watched me like grow up. Ever since I was little, you know, and I would like go to the neighborhood playground, I'd always be that girl with the fanny pack that had like band-aids and like, you know, little like first aid equipment in there. And like anytime like a kid fell off the slide or fell off the swing, like you just see this little like 5-year-old like running and putting a band-aid on him. Like it was just always in me. It was always in me to take this route. So that's pretty much how it got started.
It's quite interesting to hear. Have you ever taken your talents back to Palestine?
No, I haven't, because I'm not even done training. You know, yes, I am a paramedic, but I haven't seen anything even remotely close to what they deal with over there. So, alhamdulillah, this new job opportunity of working as a nurse in a trauma emergency room, that's going to be the real training that I need before I can take any skill sets over there, because I'm going to get patients with gunshot wounds. I'm going to get patients that have just been rescued out of a burning building. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to get patients that come into the emergency room to give birth, like right then and there, like true emergency. So I'm going to like give myself more time. I'm going to train a lot harder and, you know, learn what I can and fine tune the skills that I have and then take it there. Cause I don't want to go there and be useless. You know, there's no time to be useless. So yeah, I'm basically working hard on my skills. And then once I'm ready, I'll go there and be as useful as possible, inshallah.
Inshallah. It's interesting to hear that you have that goal in the first place. It's very encouraging.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I guess one of the other things I'm curious about is, how this whole process all began. You know, how many years have you been doing this?
So my very first exposure to healthcare was when I was 17, and I signed up at my local hospital as a volunteer. I didn't know at the time, but they would make you have very minimal contact with the patients because you're just a volunteer, you know, you haven't really been trained. So the only contact with patients I would have is, you know, a flower delivery company would deliver flowers to the hospital. And then I would take the flowers from them and deliver it to the patient. Or I would take a patient that's ready to go home, have them sit on the wheelchair and push them, you know, through the hospital, out the front door and to their taxi or to their car. That was pretty much the contact that I had with patients, you know, like if the pizza delivery guy would deliver pizza for a family or for a patient, I'd take it and bring it up to him. But that was pretty much it as a volunteer. So then I volunteered at a pediatric office because actually at the time I wanted to be a pediatrician. And then I volunteered there for like, I think 200 hours. And then I realized I didn't want to be a pediatrician. I was also 17 at the time. What turned me off from it was, one time the pediatrician was searching for a shot to give to a patient. And she was like, all right, come on, let's go. You know, this shot is refrigerated. It's in the cooler. Let's go get it. And you can help me give this shot. And I'm like, I'm so excited. And we go to this cooler and I see the shot because she told me what the name of it was. I see it literally like at the surface of the pile in the cooler, but she's not going for it. And she's digging deeper to like a certain one under. And I'm like, hey doctor, like it's right there, like it's literally there. And she's like, oh no, I don't want to use that brand. There's another brand that's paying me more commission right now to use them instead. So I'm going to use that one. And I'm like this little like innocent 17-year-old girl that doesn't care about money whatsoever. And this pediatrician that, you know, I'm looking up to just told me that. And I'm like, what? Like money? Like, you care about money? Like, I thought you're trying to help these kids. I didn't say that to her. But in my heart, I was like, ow, like that really hurt me. Like, what? So it just changed my perspective. I didn't want to be a pediatrician anymore. I wanted to be something that money didn't matter. So after that, I went and I got a job. I went to phlebotomy school and I got my certificate as a phlebotomist, and I worked in the hospital as a phlebotomist. That brought me a lot closer to different types of doctors and different types of nurses. And then I realized that I think I want to be a nurse. You know, I was like, I think I want to be a nurse instead. So I went to nursing school, and then flash forward a few semesters, I had this phase where I was just contemplating all my life decisions, and I dropped out. I didn't even show up to finals week. Long story short, the reason for that was in nursing school, in the beginning, they take you to like nursing homes, and they take you to like these basic nursing facilities, and you basically just see old people that their families let go of them, and they just drop them off at these nursing homes, and these old people are just begging to see their sons and daughters again, and they're just nowhere to be found. So I was like, you know what, like, I don't want to be a nurse here for the rest of my life. And I dropped out, and I was like, I want to do something emergency. So then I went to EMT school, went to paramedic school, became a paramedic, then gave nursing school another shot, because I was like, okay, I'll do nursing, but I'll only stay in the emergency room. That's all I want to do. So gave it another shot. And then that's basically how I got started and how I got to where I am right now.
I guess your response leaks into another question that I basically had, and that is, how much of what you actually do has a religious component behind it?
Every single encounter. I'll tell you why. So right now, as a paramedic, when I have a patient, I am alone with my patient in the back of my ambulance. It's just me and my patient. And I have this belief that the way that someone deals with someone vulnerable tells a lot about who that person is, tells a lot about who that soul is. So when I say vulnerable, I mean, how does someone deal with the elderly? Because elderly people are vulnerable. They cannot defend themselves. Children are vulnerable. They can't defend themselves. Animals are vulnerable, can't defend themselves. Sick people are so vulnerable. They can't defend themselves. Sometimes the people in the back of my ambulance are literally almost entirely unconscious. Some people, actually, a few weeks ago, my patient was actually completely unconscious. What does that mean? And I'm alone with them. That means I can do whatever I want to do. Whatever I want to do. No one's going to know. They're not going to know. Okay? I can either completely ignore their condition, you know, and just let them like deteriorate, you know, or I could do something completely unethical. I'll give you an example. When I was in paramedic school, I went and I did a paramedic clinical for a 911 department for a certain county. And we, first of all, in the firehouse, the medics that I was paired with that day, I could just tell early on the way that they were treating me, the questions they were asking me, they were like, they didn't like me. They didn't like the fact that I was Muslim. They just didn't like it. And then later that day, we got a buzzer at the 911 house, at the firehouse, and, you know, we got a call. And it was basically 24-year-old unconscious male. That's the only info we got. So we run to the ambulance, you know, lights and sirens, we're zooming through the streets, we get to the house. The moment I walk through the door of this house, I immediately know this is a Muslim family. Because you just see, like, you know, like Surat Yasin on the wall, you see Muhammad's name, Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, like on the wall. Mm-hmm. You know, you see like the masbaha, like on the counter, you know, and then this, you know, elderly grandmother comes running to us and she's wearing hijab. And I'm like, yeah, this is definitely a Muslim house. So I'm like, you know, let's find this guy. So she leads us to the bedroom of the patient. And without giving too many details, patient was completely unconscious, laying in his bed. I'm a student, mind you. I'm a student at this time. The paramedics that are there, there was, I think, 3 or 4. They're just completely relaxed. And there's literally a completely unconscious, you know, guy in bed. They're completely relaxed, not in a good way. Because I've seen them on other calls. They work quick. They're high energy. You know, like they're on top of it. So when I say that they're relaxed, I'm not saying it like, oh, they're so good at what they do that they're very relaxed. No. I'm saying it in a bad way. So they're like not really doing much. They're not even touching the patient. I like am the first person to touch the patient. And I'm like, guys, he's freezing. And then like I'm touching his skin like with my gloves, and my gloves are wet. And I'm like, guys, he's like super diaphoretic. Like he's sweating really bad, you know, and they're ignoring me. I kid you not. These guys are ignoring me.
How come?
I like, because they realize that the family was Muslim. This is truly, truly what I believe. And they just didn't care. So then I'm the first one to like, you know, be like, okay, you know what? Let me get a blood sugar on this patient. Maybe he's hypoglycemic right now. You know, maybe that's why he's, you know, in this status. So me, the student, is checking this patient's blood sugar, is listening to his lungs with the stethoscope, is going to his bedside table and looking at his medications on there to see what possibly could be what's going on. And I'm telling you, these medics are just standing there. They're standing there. They're asking stupid questions to the mother, like stupid questions. I'm like, wow, this is so bad. So, you know, they get the patient on the stretcher, and I've seen them carry other patients. Okay. So I know that they know how to properly carry an unconscious body. Man, they're carrying this patient in such a careless way. I literally was afraid that they were going to drop him because he was literally slipping out of them. And they put him on the stretcher, and then we take him to the ambulance. We put him in the ambulance, and their interaction with the family was like very minimal. And in other cases, their interaction with families was like very thorough. So we get the patient in the back of the ambulance, and this guy is unconscious. So vulnerability level, sky high. And there's like two medics back there. And I'm like, guys, we should probably cover him up. Like he's freezing. So like I said, I don't want to give too many details about what exactly happened, but the patient was only wearing an underwear. So I was like, he's freezing, you know, let's, you know, can we please cover him up? And in an ambulance, we're supposed to have blankets because it's very important to keep patients warm. So they were like, yeah, we'll cover him. And I'm like, okay, I'm a student. I don't work in this ambulance. I don't know where they keep it. So I'm waiting, and they're still not doing anything about it. So I'm like, I remind them again. The guy rolls his eyes at me, stands up so that I can get the blanket that's in the bench that's underneath him. Well, there is no blanket. And there's just this tiny little paper thin sheet. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is terrible. And they're laughing. They're like, yeah, whatever. Just use that, like, I guess for modesty. And they're laughing. So I put this little paper thin blanket on the guy. And then I'm like, guys, we should probably intubate, you know, cause like he's completely unconscious. Like we don't know why. And you know, his GCS is pretty low, probably a 7 or something. We need to intubate. And they literally laugh. And they're like, nah, we're just going to say his GCS is an 8, you know, and we're not going to intubate. So basically everything in like the ambulance world goes off of pre-written protocol. So a GCS is a score of like how like alert, like how, you know, the mental status basically of a patient. And by protocol, if it's 8, or below, then sorry, if it's below 8, you have to intubate the patient. So he's like, no, we're just going to say it's an 8 so that we don't have to intubate. And he started laughing. I'm like, oh, this is just so bad, you know? And this patient's completely unconscious. So like his head is just bobbling around. So I'm holding the patient's head so that he can just, his airway isn't compromised so that he can breathe properly. Then I was like, guys, can we give this patient some Narcan? You know? And the reason I'm asking is because I'm a student. You know, if I was actually working there, I wouldn't ask. I would just do these things myself. And I'm like, guys, we need to give this patient some Narcan. Let's just try it. Maybe this is a drug overdose. And they're like, nah, no need. You know, they're just like, it was just so bad. So we get to the ER. We roll this patient into the ER. Thankfully, it was an ER that I've done my clinicals at before. So I kind of know the doctors and the nurses there. We drop this patient off. We take the patient all the way to the room and drag this patient, you know, with the sheets they're on, onto the hospital bed. And then the other paramedics are nowhere to be found. They're gone. They're nowhere to be found. And I'm in the room. Like, I'm staying in the room. I want to know, like, what's going on. So since I'm the only one that was on that call that stayed in the room, the ER doctor turns around and looks at me. And the first question he asks is, did you guys give Narcan? I was like, oh my God. Like, I literally wanted the earth to open up and swallow me because I suggested to give Narcan and they laughed and said no. So I looked this doctor in the eye and I was like, no, we unfortunately didn't. I was so ashamed. And he was like, okay, guys, well, we need to give Narcan now. So then, you know, the ER nurse in there ran, got some Narcan. Narcan, by the way, if I didn't explain it, Narcan is a medication you use to, it's basically the antidote for a lot of drug overdoses. So if a patient overdosed on a drug, you give them a medication called Narcan. And it, you know, shuts down the actions of the drug and the patient wakes up and stuff like that. So that's what Narcan is. So nurse left, ran back, gave Narcan. And then the doctor was like, the second order, the literal second order he gave was, guys, get a bear hugger for this patient now. A bear hugger is a piece of medical equipment that you put on a patient and it blows up with warm air or hot air. And it warms the patient up. And I'm like, oh my God, literally, like, I've been wanting to warm this guy up for like so long now. So I was, again, so ashamed. And then the third thing that doctor said, the third order he gave was, we need to intubate now. I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is just so bad. This is so bad. So partially it was a huge compliment, because everything that I wanted to do, the ER doctor gave orders to do, you know? But then it was very, I was so embarrassed about it, because I was like, maybe I should have pushed harder, maybe I should have, like, but again, I was a student, so I couldn't really do much. But this is what that situation instilled in me. It showed me that there are people out there that are getting 911 calls to Muslim families. Doesn't have to just be Muslim, any minority, you know? There are racists, Islamophobes, whatever you want to call it, that are going to quote unquote save the lives of these minorities that they have for some reason, whatever it is, some hatred inside of them for. That's a problem. Because these people are vulnerable. That guy was completely unconscious. He literally, thank God, the transport time from that house to that ER was probably like 7 minutes. So thank God, because if it was longer than that, the guy would have probably died in there. You know, imagine if that transport time was like a whole hour. Like, oh my gosh, like the guy probably would have died. So it made me even more and more passionate to put myself out there online and talk about it in real life, how much we need Muslims and more minorities in EMS, in emergency medical services, in the emergency room, in the police force, in these situations where these are professionals that are dealing with vulnerable people behind closed doors, no supervision, no surveillance cameras. They can do whatever they want to do and no one's going to know about it. The only person that had an issue with what they were doing on that call was me. And I was a student. And the only reason I had an issue was because I'm not like that. Like, I don't care what you are. I'm gonna treat you like I'm supposed to treat you. I'm going to give you everything I possibly can give you, you know, because that is my beliefs as a Muslim. A soul is a soul no matter what. So that's kind of been the biggest like situation that's impacted me to really, really, really drive my passion for trying to desperately motivate other Muslims to become paramedics and to become nurses, to become people that are in situations where they're dealing with people that are vulnerable. You know, alhamdulillah, so far it's working. My sister, the 17-year-old, wants to go to paramedic school and then nursing school. My brother and my younger sister, my brother especially, wants to do it too. My younger sister, she's kind of afraid of blood, so it's not working too well with her. But we need more of me, is what I'm trying to say. I'm not enough. I'm not enough, and it kills me. It hurts me. It breaks my heart. We need more of me, like more people that are Muslims and that they have a strong moral compass, that are ethical, more of us need to be out there, more of us need to exist, because there's a lot of bad things happening, because unfortunately these departments, a lot of them are filled with unethical people, and that's just the truth.
I really like that response. One of the things I sort of gather from what you said is that there is a lot of passion for what you actually do. How important is passion to you to pursue something that you really are committed towards?
Passion is everything to me. When I am like doing clinical rotations, or when I'm wherever it is that I am, and I have questions, you know, like to ask the doctors that are working there, the nurses, you know, like you just have questions. Like before you want to become something or someone, you want to interview the people that are already doing that. One of my very first questions before I even ask them, like, you know, like, what do you do on a day-to-day basis? Like, and I have these specific questions. One of my first questions is, how happy are you doing this job? How satisfied are you doing this job? Because I have a deep, deep, deep belief that if you're not passionate about what you're doing, you're not going to do a good job. It's just go find something else to do. Because if you're not passionate about it, if you don't want to be there, if you don't feel like it's your calling, then you're not going to do a good job. The only reason I'm good at what I do is because I care, is because I have a passion for it, is because I sincerely feel like Allah chose me for it, or chose it for me. You know what I mean? I'm not doing it for the paycheck. And there's people that actually do it for the paycheck, and they're terrible providers. Passion is everything. Passion is number one. Don't do this if you don't have the passion for it. Don't. Why? Because you're going to have patients that, if you don't have passion for the profession, these patients are just going to drain you. I have patients that have cursed at me. I have patients that have spit at me. I had patients that have had psychotic episodes, and in the middle of like a room full of patients, you know, have, you know, said like a bunch of like absurd things, like, oh no, she's a Muslim, she's crazy, don't let her touch you. You know what I'm saying? Imagine if I didn't have passion. Like, I would have ran away from this profession a long time ago. In this profession, we barely get thanked. Barely do people say thank you. Like, and I'm saying patients, I'm saying other nurses, other medics, other doctors, barely do you get thanked. And if you're doing it for the thanks, if you're doing it for the money, you're going to be miserable. You got to do it because you're passionate about it. You got to do it because you have like a belief inside you that makes you really believe that this is what you're meant to do. This is where you belong. This is your everything. This is your profession. God chose you for this. Passion is everything to me.
Look, I think that's an interesting point that you've raised. You know, a lot of people are unaware that nurses that work in this particular field, they sometimes have to put up with abuse. Is that something common in your line of work? More common than I think?
I think it's a lot more common than people think. So the most abuse that I've gotten was, I went into this patient's room, and from the get-go, he was wearing like a United States veterans hat, you know, which is awesome. Oh. Like, yeah, but it's like, you know, like,
I know where this is going.
Yeah. But I see those people all the time, you know, and usually they're awesome people. Like, there's, you know, but sometimes some of them get very abusive and they have certain beliefs, you know what I mean? So this one in particular, he was very abusive towards me, first verbally and then physically. So first verbally, he was like, he accused me of knowing the terrorist secret plots and not reporting it to the government. This is what his verbal accusation was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was like, so at that time, and I probably didn't mention this earlier, but I've been in so many roles, I forget what they are. So at that time, I was working on an orthopedic unit as a nurse technician. So very basic level job, taking care of patients. I was only in there, you know, in the morning to erase the last name of the tech that was on there and to write my name down and to introduce myself. That's really what I was in there for. And he just started with his accusations. And I was like, sir, I don't know what you're talking about, but I don't know anything about what you're saying, and I'm only here as your nurse tech for the day, blah, blah, blah. And I'm being so nice to him. I'm smiling. I'm being so nice. And he's just going on with his verbal accusations. So then there's this table. I don't know if you've ever been in a hospital, but they have like this bedside table with wheels on it and stuff. And it was kind of like hovered over him. And then I was standing behind it. So the table was between him and I. And this is a big guy. And he's in the hospital because he has a broken shoulder and a broken leg. Okay. And I'm there to help him. And he's there to abuse me. Ironic. But he pushed his table at me. So with such like strength, and I was not ready for it. I did not expect him to do that. It hit me like kind of like at my hips, lower abdomen area, and it hurt. And like I could just feel that like the tears were coming up, you know? So I just turned around and left. I was like, oh my God, like this is bad. I did not expect that. I could deal with verbal abuse, but when it gets physical, I can't do that. So I went to the unit supervisor and I told him, and he was like, what? I was like, yeah, like, can I please like not be assigned that patient anymore? Like, he's dangerous. And they were like, no. So they went in there and they talked to him. Later on, they told me that I don't need to go in there anymore. So like, thank you. Later on, that patient kept on pressing his call light, and he really needed help, but everybody on the unit was busy. So I went into his room and I stayed like at the door, and I was like, hey sir, it's me again. I see that you're pressing your call light. As you know, I've been assigned another patient instead of you because of what you've done earlier. And everybody else on the unit is busy. So I'm available to help you, but you've hurt me. So I don't really know if I should be in this room or not helping you. And he like sighed and he was like, no, I regret what I did. I'm sorry. And I just really needed help with setting up my food. Cause the guy, like I said, like he has broken bones like everywhere. So like vulnerable, right? He's vulnerable. Even though he was strong with his other arm, he was still vulnerable. And I was also vulnerable because of what he did to me earlier. But I went in there and I literally imagined the simplicity of what he wanted. He literally wanted me to open his carton of milk, put a straw in it, and then take the lid off of his lunch and like cut up the meat for him so that he could eat, because, you know, he's in so much pain. So I did that for him. And over the course of doing that, we were talking, and he was like, you know, I'm really sorry. I don't know why I said what I said. You seem like a very nice person, and I don't know why I did that. And I was like, it's okay, but it really hurt what you said, and I want you to know that, you know, it's not just me. It shouldn't stop with me, you know. Like, the next time you see another Muslim, like, please, like, don't do what you just did. And he was like, no, honestly, I'm embarrassed, I'm sorry, blah blah blah. So that's a story of how like an abusive patient turned into an apologetic patient who was actually curious about my deen and actually had questions after that. Other than that, the abuse that I usually get is from patients that are already having psychological issues. So like, I don't really care because, you know, they're psychotic. So whatever, what more can you expect, you know? Other than that, alhamdulillah, I think people these days, if you approach someone with kindness, I think it right away melts the curtain of Islamophobia that they once had up, and they give you a chance because you're giving them a chance. So what I'm trying to say is I come across patients every single day where I feel like that patient potentially looks like they could be very racist, you know, and I never pay it any attention. I make a conscious effort to never give too much attention to that fact. And I'm happy with them. I'm smiling with them. I'm cracking jokes with them. I'm being sarcastic. I'm being funny. I'm being me. Okay. I'm being me. I'm not being, you know, anything that's like unnatural. And later on, they're like, you know, you're the first Muslim I actually ever talked to. You're pretty cool. And I'm like, wow, thanks. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is situations that could become abusive because we have a little fear in us, you know, they don't become abusive if you don't feed that fear. Because at the end of the day, the way I see it is, it's one soul interacting with another soul. And no matter how hateful someone could be, you can't fool your soul into believing that, I'm actually evil, into believing that I'm actually a terrorist or I'm actually a bad person. You can't fool your soul. You can't. So if you just, you know, go down to that level, go down to the pure level of soul with soul, instead of, you know, like a corrupt human dealing with another human, I think a lot of the conversations change.
I really like that story, actually. I think one of the things that it kind of illustrates to me is that not everyone can do this line of work that you're in. Maybe it takes a specific personality type to do it, perhaps.
Here's the thing. I'm a very, how do I say this? I'm not the type of person that has ever snapped back or clapped back at someone. So I don't really have a strong personality in that sense. You know, I'm not the type of person that, like, someone disses me, I diss them back. I've never been like that, even in school, like even when I was like in elementary school, middle school. So I've always been a very like passive person, you know, like I'm not looking for trouble. I'm not looking for problems. I've always been that kind of person. That I feel is a weakness in this field. I feel like that's a weakness. I feel like a lot of times I wish I had a louder mouth. Sometimes I wish that there was something that I said, but I didn't say it because I avoid issues. I don't want issues. I avoid them at all cost. And that's, I feel, not a good thing. So if someone, like, it amazes me that someone could look at me and be like, yeah, like, you're doing well in this field because you have the personality for it. Like, I'm like, what? Me? Like, this passive, like, overly kind person? Are you kidding me? Like, I feel like people that do well in this field are people that are, like, you know, like strong spoken. People that, like, if someone says something wrong, you know, they're like, they're able to, like, quickly, like, stand up for themselves verbally and say something verbally. Me, I'm not like that. Me, if someone says something wrong, I kind of just try to, like, rationalize with them, talk some sense into them, try to, like, show them why what they're saying is wrong, is hurtful. Like, I always try to go down to the level of the soul, you know? I don't care, like, if someone was brought up to be racist. I always go down to the level of the soul. The soul is not racist, you know? It's not. It's the upbringing that makes the person racist. So I always try to go back to that level. But again, like, I feel like, how could someone look at me and be like, you have the perfect personality for this? I feel like, no. I feel like there's other people that would survive much better than I can. And I'm surviving, so, you know, I feel like don't let it stop you. I don't think anyone should think that they don't have what it takes, you know, to be in this.
Very good. So how many years have you actually been a paramedic?
I graduated from paramedic school in December 2018. So I've only been a paramedic for like a year and a few months now.
So when did this idea of going online come about?
This idea is old. This idea came
about... Oh, it predated your studies.
I think it came about when I realized that I was the only Muslim in my nursing class. Literally, like, my nursing class had, like, my specific one had, I think, 70 students, but then the entire, like, school had, like, over, like, a couple thousand, and I was the only Muslim, the only hijabi. I was like, what is going on? Like, why only, like, why? This makes no sense. So I went back to my very first video on Instagram, and it was October 17, 2016. Yeah, so it's been a bit, and the reason it started was because of how much it bothered me that I was the only one, and that's why I named it what I named it, you know? Like, I named it Hijabi Nurse because I want to show people that it's something that I'm not just wearing it because, like, of any reason, like, any negative reason. Like, I'm wearing it because of positive reasons, and on top of that, I'm proud of it.
So how is it that you generally accumulated this audience of yours? Was it through this kind of engagement, or was it through something else?
So before Instagram, actually, I was on Snapchat. And on Snapchat, what I was doing was I was literally talking to my audience on Snapchat every single day, multiple times a day, and I would take them through what I'm doing at work. So every little thing I'm doing, I would show it to them, you know, like, this is how I take a blood sample, and I would show it to them. This is how I, you know, do this, and just show it to them. And the responses I would get would be like, wow, like, this is amazing. You know, I really want to do this. And my audience didn't just have Muslims, it had non-Muslims in it too. And they were also inspired. So when, if my audience was Muslim, usually the response I would get was, you inspire me so much, like, as a hijabi, to not let the hijab stop me. And then the response I would get from people that are non-Muslim would be, you know, basically the same thing, minus the part with the hijab, you know? Mm.
So at what point did you actually become the hijabi nurse? Were you that from the beginning, or is it something that you recently took on, a name that you recently took on, or it's been like that from the beginning?
No, it's been like that from the beginning. I had a personal Instagram account and a personal Snapchat account, and it was just like my name. But it wasn't really, there was no like real purpose or intention behind it. You know, it was just like, you know, whatever, like it's a personal blog account, you know, whatever. There's no true purpose. Then I felt like I needed to reach out to an audience with a specific purpose. And then that's when I, you know, created a brand new account and named it The Hijabi Nurse from the get-go. And the name has never changed. And from, you know, from the creation of the account until now, the goal and the intention and the passion has never changed. It's stayed the same.
One of the things we know about social media is that it can be used for very positive things. It can be used for very, very negative things. I think there is a trend at the moment amongst some younger sisters and even brothers as well to sort of make it about the person. And you see that sometimes in these you know, the photos they take about themselves, you know, mm-hmm. these posing, everything like that. At some point, at some level, it can become quite sexualized. What is mm-hmm. your opinion about this?
My first opinion is, it's funny you mentioned that. If you look at my Instagram, my name is nowhere to be found because it doesn't matter. My entire goal with my account, and I purposely don't put my name in because I don't want it to be about me. I want my existence online to be a hijabi character who is set to inspire. You don't need to attach a name to it. I don't really get too personal in any of my posts, if you notice. And it's because of what you just said. It's not about me. It's about something much bigger than me. So that's number one. Number two, I completely agree with you. So here's the problem. The problem is with people kind of becoming more like not modest, you know, showing off more of their bodies. Unfortunately, the effect of it is positive in a sense, as in they get more followers, they get more comments, they're going to get more likes, because unfortunately, that's just the way that it is. So when people realize that, it feeds their ego in a way that becomes so like addicting, and now they want more. So they want to post more things that require, you know, either taking off less clothes or making your clothes more tight, or, you know, just, and even if you're a guy, like, you know, taking topless pictures or looking into the camera in a certain way, like those things unfortunately give people more followers and more comments and more likes, and it becomes addicting, like I said, and it's addicting to the ego, and now they want more of it. And that's why, you know, a lot of times you'll see like accounts that have literally started and have literally grown on the idea of this is an account of a hijabi trying to inspire. Then after this certain hijabi reaches a couple thousand followers, the hijab comes off. Listen, if there's an account of a girl without a hijab, that's okay. There's no issue with that. I don't have an issue with that. But I find it so wrong that if you grew your audience because of your hijab, then after you attain your large following, you take it off, you've kind of cheated everybody. You've kind of like who are you now? You know what I mean? Like that, it's so wrong. It is so wrong to do something like that. Yeah, I think it comes down to, feeding the ego. So like, if you look at my account, I have 3,000 followers. In the online world, man, that's nothing. That is nothing in the online world. But to me, that means I have 3,000 quality people that believe in my message and want more of it and are inspired by it. That I'm so happy with that. Yeah. I am so happy with that. You know, I'm not looking for like hundreds of followers a day, hundreds of comments a day. Like, I keep my ego down. Like, my ego is so small, I barely even have one. And I take pride in that. And it's, you can't really put ego and pride in the same sentence. But anyway, like, you have to stay humble. You have to stay humble. Otherwise, the social media world will wrap you around its finger and you will become enslaved to it.
So as we kind of wrap up, what is one message that you would like others to take away from everything that you've...
All right. I would say passion, ethics, moral values, and high standards will take you far. If you have these things, go after whatever it is that you want to go after. If you're an artistic type of person, go the artistic route, but stay passionate, stay moral, keep your standards high, and never forget who you are, and never be afraid to represent who you are. You know, if you take that down the healthcare path, the same thing applies. If you take it down like any path you can possibly think of, if you have those qualities, you can go far and you'll be happy in your route there. Definitely be involved, be active. When I first started, I had a lot more time. So I was actually volunteering a lot, like so much. And I think about it periodically. I'm like, oh my God, like I need to volunteer again. Like there's something special about being active without receiving any financial like gain in return. There's something so special about it. So yeah, definitely be active. And if that means being active online or being active as a volunteer in real life or whatever way you have found to be active, it keeps your passion going.
I guess one of the things I also respect is your willingness to even participate in this podcast. So thank you for being involved and thank you for being a part of it. I guess you didn't have a reason to do so. So I really thank you for taking part and wanting to be a part of Kalamcast. So may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reward you.
Ameen, jamian. Ameen for you too. Honestly, like I'm so proud of what you guys are doing. Like this is awesome. This is so awesome. You're giving a voice to Muslims around the world, you know, having us share our perspective and our lives. It's inspiring. It really is. It's so inspiring. And honestly, like if there's any way that I can support, like I'm so down.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hijabi Nurse. Your name is actually mentioned on the top, so I'm just careful not to actually mention it since you mentioned that you didn't want it coming out. So I thank you once again for your time, and I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he brings barakah in whatever it is that you're trying to teach and provide for members of our community. And thank we you, hope you too. That you succeed in whatever it is that you do in the future, inshallah.
Inshallah, you too, and inshallah for the entire, you know, Muslim ummah and anyone who's passionate. Inshallah, ya Rabbi.